Welcome to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdowne discussing hot topics in sports medicine and society. We hope you enjoy our podcast and look forward to hearing from you.
I'm Brian Feely, and I'm joined by my colleagues at UCSF, Drew Lansdowne and Nirav Pandya. Nirav is typically our primary host, but unfortunately he's suffering some technical difficulties, so he may be joining us a little bit later. We're also going to be joined by our first guests, Johanna and Kangsu Gatlin. They are parents of an outstanding young basketball player, Xavier Gatlin, and they're going to talk about their experience with getting a second opinion in the healthcare system. To that end, I wanted to talk tonight about something that often can feel offensive for doctors as well as patients, obtaining a second opinion about a medical treatment or test. The choice to get a second opinion can feel like a complicated decision. For patients, they can worry about the cost, sometimes the need to travel farther to have the opinion, and they worry about the fact that they may get divergent opinions without an exact answer about what to do with them. And finally, they may worry about offending the treating physician. Second opinions are actually a pretty common practice now, but they came about overall pretty recently. It was in the 1970s that they were actually started by insurance companies as part of a utilization review technique that was used to reduce costs for overuse and inappropriate surgeries. At that time, about 50% of insurance companies provided them, but they weren't really shown to decrease cost. And as we moved to prepaid insurance, the use of second opinions dropped dramatically in the 1980s. To 1990. More recently, with the advent of online second opinion companies and the need of for many states to require or at least urge patients to get a second opinion prior to a surgical procedure being authorized, there's been an increase in patients obtaining second opinions. So Drew, what is a second opinion and why do you think people get them at least in orthopedic surgery?
Yeah, and so I think of a second opinion just as when a patient is coming to see us, they already have a diagnosis established, probably received some recommendations with regards to treatment plan, and they just have lingering questions, either if there's a different treatment plan that may be better or if they should be considering a different diagnosis. And I think a lot of it, it's either in the setting of a complex injury, complex condition, where it may not be a straightforward answer. So you may have different opinions depending on who you speak to, or if just the communication with that first visit is not optimal. So people are left with questions that they feel aren't addressed and looking to just maybe have the problem and treatment outlined in a different way so they can hopefully understand it better as they're trying to figure out next steps.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge because oftentimes what it can be routine for us will not be routine for patients. And I think that's one of the things that we often teach the residents is that something that we may see 100 times in a year, for instance, something like frozen shoulder, a patient may have never heard of, their primary care physician may have little experience with. And so the first time they see somebody with a diagnosis of frozen shoulder, a patient is left with more questions than answers. So I think it's often on the providers to take a step back and explain even the most straightforward diagnoses for us to a patient as if it's the first time that we've ever heard them as well. And I feel a lot of the times a second opinion is very confirming for patients where I agree with the primary treating physician and say, yeah, I totally agree. I'm just going to explain it in a slightly different way. And oftentimes I think hearing it the second time often makes it a lot easier for a patient to digest because it's 90% the same information just in a slightly different fashion. How effective do you think they are in conveying information better than the first one?
I think it's kind of mixed. I think there are times where like you said, people just don't kind of pick up on the information the first time. And maybe that they come in with a different expectation than what they receive. And then kind of expectations change for that second visit. And then they just receive the information differently. I think there are other times where it may even introduce more confusion at times where, you're looking at the same problem and you have two surgeons or two providers giving fairly different options, and then the patient's still left wondering, how do they then pick between those two? And often introduce even more questions. And then you get into the third opinion or fourth opinion, and sometimes having too much information can also be difficult. How effective do you think they are?
Yeah, I think they're great for straightforward problems. And I think most of the time when I do second opinions, it's really confirming what the first person said in a slightly different manner, especially if it's somebody that I know or it's somebody that's trained in a similar fashion. I think one thing that we don't talk about too much is that styles and treatment algorithms are often based on how we train and who we trained with. So for instance, if I see a large rotator cuff tear in an older patient, I might be more likely to offer one type of repair, whereas somebody else who trained with a different set of surgeons in a different part of the country might actually recommend a different treatment option that both options are equally viable, but they're what are more comfortable in our hands, which is probably something that shouldn't be discounted. I think I totally agree with you for the ones that are more complicated. Seeing somebody where there's no perfect answer, especially when you're seeing surgeons when there isn't really a surgical answer, or seeing a non-operative provider when the answer is really a surgical answer, can often lead to three or four or five different opinions. And I think in the end, that we tend to try to do this model of shared decision-making where we use the patients to help us make a decision. We try to give the patients as much information as possible. And in a perfect world, that works every time, and we are able to give the patients the right information. But I totally agree. Once you have a complicated problem and we don't have the right decision-making options to give, more opinions sometimes can be more harmful rather than good. What are the typical things that you end up seeing in orthopedic surgery for second opinions?
I think we see at UCSF a good number of patients with cartilage injuries especially. That's one of the more common complex conditions in the knee. And there are a variety of treatment options, and some aren't widely available outside of more specialized institutions. So definitely get people coming in for those types of issues. And then I know we also see a lot of patients with shoulder replacements or for revision shoulder replacements too, where they've been told a few different things and looking for further answers. And then, I think one thing that you've done too a lot is like an online second opinion. What's been your experience with that, and how much value do you think that adds to care?
Yeah, I think, in the last 3 or 5 years, there've been an increase in companies that provide these online second opinions. And I think they've sprung up for a couple of different reasons. One, I think they give options for patients to expand their horizon and get second opinions from people across the country. It allows patients that have requirements within their insurance providers, especially through workers' compensation or job-related injuries, to get that required second opinion in a timely fashion. And it allows people with complicated problems to seek medical advice from people that essentially of their choosing across the country. So overall, I think it's a great service. What I'm particularly impressed by is how many times I agree with 90% of what the doctor says. So I think the most common one that I see is my doctor has recommended me to have a surgery, especially a meniscus surgery or a rotator cuff surgery. And when I read the notes, the notes actually say, well, one of the options is surgery, but we're also recommending you can try physical therapy, and here are the different options. And the reality is I think what happens is for the patient, when the first time they hear the word, you may need surgery for this, their brain logically shuts off, and that's all they hear after that. So I get the opportunity to be the one that essentially types out a response that says, well, yes, surgery might be the best option, but here are the other options. But overall, I'm consistently impressed with how many times that we all agree in the medical community what to do. It's just a flavor of how we say it. And I think the other thing that's interesting, especially in watching how kids communicate now and how young adults communicate, we tend to use text and the written word a lot more than verbal instruction. So whereas my generation is used to standing in front of lectures, learning through osmosis by sitting in lecture halls, I think especially our younger patients, they kind of absorb that information written, and they're able to take it in better when it's written rather than essentially dictated to them at the end of a clinic visit. So I think it's a really effective way to utilize different forms of communication. So as our junior member of our sports medicine group, one of the things that patients often struggle with is they often want to get a second opinion from a more senior person. Are you ever offended when patients ask, can you get a second opinion, or can you refer me to one of my one of your colleagues for a difference of opinion because you look so young?
Yeah. I never am offended by it. And I think, you know, what I've done is think of it just from that patient perspective. Because I think deciding to have surgery, it is a big decision. And I think one of the best things is to make sure that you go into it comfortable, that you feel like as a patient, that you feel confident, that, you know, you really believe in the treatment plan. And especially when you're doing like an elective procedure, like if there is doubt, I think it's worth, looking to answer those questions, and whether that's reading, if it's a second opinion, whatever it is. So anytime patients ask, like I'm always very comfortable with it, because I think it will just end up making them more comfortable with, those treatment decisions. And the final goal is to make sure that people are taken care of well and comfortable with, the treatment that they're having. So I don't personally find it offensive at all. Do you?
Only if they're referred to you after me, but other than that, not too often. I think, initially I definitely almost looked forward to it, because sometimes with complicated cases, I wanted to see what people outside, especially my own institution, would want to do with procedures. I'm never offended by it, but I do think sometimes that when patients are seeking around for either the right fit or the right surgeon, that sometimes they're putting the wrong things forward. So I'm not personally offended by them, but sometimes I think we allow patients to focus on the wrong thing. So for instance, patients will often ask, well, exactly what type of fixation are you going to use for an ACL? My friend had this. Are you going to use the fixation my friend had? And the reality is, I think that the vast majority, if not every surgeon, is going to do the procedure exactly how they feel is going to be best for that patient. There's no ill will, obviously, and they're going to use their techniques and their styles to allow them to get the best possible outcome, because they want what's best for the patient. So I don't think I'm ever really offended by it, but I think sometimes shopping around for the right answer leads patients sometimes down the wrong path. And I try to caution my patients that absolutely, here are the people that I would recommend that I think are both great within our institution and within the area. And if you want to go someplace nationally, here are some names that I think of people who are outstanding. But I really caution them for things that I think are important in what to ask for their condition. I think one thing that we don't talk about too much with second opinions is how often we ask each other for advice or help on a case. When I was doing some research for this podcast, I was looking for when the advent of tumor boards were, which were really one of the multidisciplinary second opinions. And what happened with that was that people realized that a single tumor doctor wasn't sufficient to treat complicated things such as tumors. So they started getting bigger and bigger groups together. So how do you think it's changed when we have groups of orthopedic surgeons or groups of oncologists together to kind of offer second opinions before the patient even realized they've achieved that without having to go see a second opinion?
Yeah, I think it's great. I think, the patients really benefit a lot from having a number of different people reviewing their injury, their condition, their imaging, what's been done in the past, and then offering, their individual insight into it. And, even just tonight we had our sports group meets and reviews interesting and complicated cases. And, we have 7 to 10 physicians who are reviewing it all and making sure that treatment plans look appropriate and that everybody can kind of come to an agreement about like what the best course of action is. And I think, it's great when you have a bigger group where people can provide input like that. And as a practicing surgeon too, it also just helps keep you up to date on, what others are doing and what other techniques are possible. And and then, occasionally pick up things that you didn't think of yourself. And, just I think if one person looking at it is good, then having a group is only better.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about working with a group, and I think most places as physicians have transitioned into group practices, they rely on each other, both kind of as a check rein to make sure for complicated cases, am I doing the right thing? And also as a quality improvement to make sure that with, to a certain extent, with peer pressure, I want to be as good, if not better, than everyone in my group. And it really elevates how we all practice medicine within these, you know, essentially these pods of sports medicine or pods of spine surgeons, where we challenge each other to do as well as possible. So I think from a patient standpoint, they often don't realize that they may have already achieved having a second, third, and fourth opinion all within a group, and we're providing the consensus opinion to them, and that helps us probably as much as that helps the patients. Yeah. Okay. So we're joined by Johanna and Kangsu Gatlin. They are the parents of Xavier Gatlin, who is a rising 11, almost 12-year-old who plays a variety of sports, but especially basketball. So Joe and Kangsu, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us. Can you give us a little background on Xavier, the sports that he likes to play, and what happened with his knee?
Yeah, sure. Xavier, you know, he's been into sports pretty much his whole life. You know, as a little kid, he was really into soccer, was his first, I would say, passion. Although probably about the age of 8, he retired from soccer. And probably around about the age of 4 or so, he got into basketball, maybe 3 or 4 in that time frame. So, and then basketball, and then later flag football. He actually really wanted to play tackle football a lot, but that's just been off the table for us. Basketball, flag football, and also he played one season of baseball, but he didn't love baseball. It was a little bit too slow for him. So he's played basketball, flag football, and in basketball he plays pretty competitively. Starting in second grade, he played for a travel team that was composed of just like all stars from a local league. And then in third grade, he tried out for a travel team that, again, was a very competitive travel team. You know, we traveled mostly up and down the West Coast, but at one point, this team was ranked number one on the West Coast and ranked nationally as well. So yeah, that's been his background. In terms of the injury happened in third grade, where during a game, he fell, and one of the players on the opposing team fell on his leg. And he came out of the game as a result of that injury, and it hurt, but then he actually went back in that same game and played some more. Joe,
hi, and thank you for having us. Yeah, that pretty much about sums it up. He came out of the game, he went back in the game, and then he pretty soon after came back out of the game again, just limping and complaining of it hurting. It seemed to be a little bit unusual in that Xavier tends to have a pretty high pain threshold. And there's definitely an undertone with sports parents, and especially of an elite competitive club, of just tough it out, right? You don't cry when you're hurt. If it hurts, you just go back in and you keep playing. So the fact that Xavier didn't want to keep playing was, number one, alarming to us. Number two, Xavier knows that we don't condone that mentality of just like tough it out. Like if you're hurt, you need to step out and see what's going on. So it did strike us as, okay, something's really going on with his knee. We did follow up with his pediatrician after about a week and it continued to hurt. The alarming thing was he was saying that he didn't want to do anything on the playground at school, which was a huge change for Xavier. So we took him to his pediatrician. They said, you know, ice and ibuprofen, and just kind of ease back on sports a little bit, for a week. So we did that. And it felt a little bit better. But the more Xavier would amp up, the more it would start hurting. So we went back to the pediatrician again. Got the same advice, and this time she referred us to a sports med physician who actually ended up diagnosing a meniscus issue. And he said that he thought that PT would be appropriate. So we did about 6 weeks of PT, and we went back to that same sports med doctor, and he said it was actually worse with the measurements, with the swelling. It was actually worse with PT. So that's when he said, let's do an MRI.
So yeah, and then when Oh, go ahead.
At that point, was he feeling worse, or was he back to himself? And what was going through your head as to, you know, how things were looking?
So Xavier definitely felt guarded. So we noticed when he would run, his gait was different. So he seemed, his leg was a lot stiffer. He was kind of swinging his leg out rather than his usual kind of strong running gait. So we noticed that was changing. And he was definitely much more guarded in general on the court. So it didn't really sit well with us, just the whole ibuprofen. Plus, we don't like to give a lot of stuff like ibuprofen on a regular basis anyways. So in terms of what was going through our mind, we thought, well, this definitely seems bigger than just a strain of some sorts. And of course, the MRI came back with a cyst. And so the cyst kind of added a little angle to it, where they thought, okay, well, there's a cyst. There could have been, we were told there could have been an ACL tear, a small tear that healed. So let's just rest Xavier and take it from there.
Yeah. Also, yeah, when we did the MRI, they didn't see a meniscus tear in the MRI. So at that point, we pretty much forgot about the meniscus tear because nobody talked about that anymore. And everything was just focused on the cyst and possibly it emanating from an ACL tear.
Yeah. So what was it like for Xavier with it? I mean, I'm sure for him, he probably knew of some athletes that had had these injuries, but how did he take the injury and how did he feel when he couldn't play up to his normal level?
Xavier at first was, I would say, frustrated. And this was the disconcerting thing, the whole, you know, tough it out mentality. And this is what I advocate strongly now. That's completely unnecessary because kids who are playing sports love to play sports and they're going to do whatever they can to be out there on the court, including hiding injuries that they have or minimizing the pain that they're in, which was the situation in Xavier's case. He was frustrated because he didn't have the stamina that he did without having pain. So we were giving him braces, we were icing it after games, we were giving him ibuprofen, but it finally got to the point where he couldn't play and he would come out crying and we could no longer, and this whole time, you know, we're following the advice of doctors, but it just got to the point where we couldn't bear to see him like that anymore. Something was just not right.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's important. One thing that you said that's important is it's completely unnecessary to tell kids that like sports to tough it out. And if they don't like sports, we should probably let them not like sports, or at least the sport that they're doing. I mean, my daughter still brags about the fact that she completely lied about her concussion protocol test after she got hit in the back of the head with a softball bat. And she's so proud of herself now to be able to say, yeah, oh, I made things up so I could get back a little bit quicker. Right. So at this point, you know, what happened next? He wasn't able to play. And then you were getting some information about it's an ACL, but it doesn't look quite like an ACL. What happened next for you all and Xavier?
Well, we call it kind of rest number one. That was when he first was diagnosed with the cyst. Then he was fine playing for a while. I'd say for a few months. He would, you know, ice and ibuprofen, and that was the usual name of the game. We would sometimes have to limit his minutes just to make sure that he wasn't playing too much on it. And then comes the summer when there are summer basketball camps right and left. So we signed him up for all of these summer basketball camps, and that's when it really started amping up. So he started having pain again. So we took him back to his physical therapist. And it was there that they noticed that he had a massive restriction of mobility, like reduced mobility when they would maneuver his knee. And they said, it's almost like there's something in there. And Xavier went from having some pain to excruciating pain. And so that's when we knew something was wrong. When he started pulling back and not wanting to play on his knee as much, when he started having that pain just with the physical therapy maneuvering, that's when we took him back to the doctor who did the original MRI. And that kind of set everything in motion for what we call rest number two. Rest number two was, you know, well, we think Xavier we think that he maybe just has the cyst again. We could just like have him rest it out and see what happens. It didn't sit right with us because Xavier was in so much pain, and we had not had a follow-up MRI from his original MRI. So we actually had to push really hard for that MRI. It was suggested to us that maybe we just do an ultrasound, but knowing that something was probably possibly really wrong, we advocated for an MRI, which that MRI came back, still not showing a meniscus tear, but it showed a golf ball sized cyst. So the cyst had gotten a lot larger, which was obviously then a concern.
Sure. So how was Xavier's surgery and recovery, especially since you ended up traveling two states away to get the surgery?
Yeah, I mean, the surgery went, I think as good as can be expected, in the sense of, you know, what he had to have done. He had to have a meniscus repair and then also the cyst removed. So, you know, we knew after the surgery, we knew it would be a long recovery, but the surgery went really well. The anesthesia, you know, was excellent. Xavier basically felt no pain. I think we gave him pain meds for like one dose, just preemptively. But then after that, we never had to do anything with respect to pain for him, except for just like ibuprofen. So that aspect of it went, I think, just really well. And you know what we've seen, of course, in recovery. We came back to Seattle after having the surgery in the Bay Area. And so he's done the recovery over here, and we were able to work with a doctor who was familiar with the surgeon up here in Seattle who worked with them, and then physical therapist here. And again, I think the recovery has also gone about as perfect as one could want.
Yeah, and I think the two go hand in hand. To backtrack to the surgery just a little bit, so prior to the surgery, Dr. Pandya communicated really, really well with both Xavier and us about the different scenarios. And so Xavier was well prepared. This could just be a simple cyst removal. It could be a partial or full ACL reconstruction. It could be a meniscus. And then he gave us the prognosis with each scenario. So while we were waiting during Xavier's surgery, we knew, okay, a half an hour has passed. This, we might be looking at a meniscus or something else. So we were really well informed, which obviously going through something like this for any parent would produce anxiety. But we felt that we had information to kind of prepare for the different scenarios. Then after surgery, as Xavier literally came out of anesthesia, and then he sees his leg in the brace, he immediately said, "Mom, it's meniscus, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." And I think that the fact that Dr. Pandya had prepared him so well, it wasn't traumatic, right? It was difficult, but it wasn't traumatic. And that began the recovery process of him, Xavier, taking control of his body and what his body does and what he does for his body. So that was huge. That set him immediately in the right headspace to get ready for recovery. And the recovery, I mean, the first couple of days, of course, coming out of anesthesia and getting used to a wheelchair, no pressure, that was really, really difficult for a child who is as active as Xavier is. But just kind of preparing him mentally. And that's really what this is all about. We told Xavier there are, you know, young athletes where you're developing skills. There are young athletes where you have to develop the mental aspect of the game, and that mental aspect that can be applied to life. And this is just his time to work on the mental, emotional aspect of that. So we worked really hard to try to help that shift take place prior to surgery. I think that also helped in recovery. But Dr. Pandya was incredibly thorough prior to surgery, during surgery, and then in recovery. I have never seen such detailed notes and directions and instructions. It gave us incredible peace of mind because we knew exactly what to do. We had a wheelchair set up for us. We knew exactly when he would be able to get out of that wheelchair and start putting pressure on his leg. There was continuity of care with Dr. Hagen, Mia Hagen up here in Seattle. And it was just, it was an incredible experience. So we couldn't have asked for better.
Well, I'm glad he couldn't make this podcast because I think his head would have exploded with all those compliments. So looking back, what would you have done differently if you knew now, if you knew back then what you know now, would you have done anything differently? Or do you think you did everything pretty much the same, you would have done everything pretty much the same way?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think, you know, it seems like it would have, you know, maybe benefited to have the surgery earlier. He went, you know, he played, you know, with the meniscus tear and the original ACL test for a year and a half.
So did that make it worse?
Yes. Yeah. So we don't know if that made it worse, increased like the length of the tear or anything like that. Then again, it just seems so difficult to just early on make a call to do surgery on a young kid. So I feel like that's something that maybe we would have done differently, but I don't even know if I would have. I mean, I feel like that would have still been such a tough call to have made as a parent.
I think the tricky thing for us is so oddly enough, even though Xavier continued to play on it, we were kind of seeing Dr. Feely as the soft parent. So Xavier, he got hurt, you know, this was not a wear and tear type of injury. We've seen other kids his age with wear and tear injuries. But even so, it was an injury that took place during a game. Xavier continued to play on it as long as he did. But with our icing after games, we were actually regarded as soft parents for that. But I would say that I would scale back even more and just not allow him to play. If there's any pain, I wish when I saw him running with a stiff gait, I wish I would have said, you're not playing until we get this completely checked out. We trusted that doctors, you know, were giving us good advice, and I think they were to the extent that they could. I also think that there's immense pressure to just get the kids back out there on the court and play, or get the kids back out there on the field and play. I think there's a lot of pressure. And if some parents don't hear what they want to hear, they'll go to a different doctor. So we're not those parents, but I think that there's a lot of pressure for that. So I wish that I would have followed my gut instinct and scaled back a lot earlier.
I think that's a great point that, you know, it's a balance between trying to get the right information from getting second opinions and getting the right information that you want. And they're definitely this, I think it ended up great for Xavier, but I can certainly see parents, and I've seen parents in clinic where I'm the third or fourth opinion and all the doctors have agreed that this kid is injured and needs surgery, even though the parents and kids don't recover it. And I still remember having a kid who the parents definitely didn't want him to have an ACL surgery. They're like, no, he'll recover, he'll heal up well. I was, absolutely not. Please go see the movie Friday Night Lights and then come back and report to me. And sure enough, they went and saw the movie and they signed up for surgery 2 weeks later. And so it's not the first time I've used a movie to plead my case, but it is important for when doctors have to basically stick to their guns and give the best advice, even when parents or patients are trying their best to get the advice that they want to hear, not what they need to hear.
Absolutely. And there are parents. I mean, there's a lot of different motivating factors at play. I mean, we've known of a player who played with a broken ankle. There's just a lot, literally a broken ankle. There's a lot of pressure, pressure coming from the parents. Some of the kids, as they get older, they have that internal pressure. But at these younger ages, a lot of the pressure comes from parents. And I think sometimes as parents, we need to take a step back and think, you know, what is the end game? What is the goal to this? You know, is it to get a college scholarship? Is that ultimately the goal? Because if so, parents still need to scale back and protect their child's bodies. Because one thing that was completely sobering to me was seeing Xavier's MRI and seeing the area where his growth plate was and thinking about the kind of training that Xavier does, which was very minor compared to what some of his teammates would do. And I just think about these bones and tendons and the bodies just grinding it out. And by the time they get older, you know, their bodies are going to be worn out. So to think about the end game and to think about really kind of measuring out how much time they play, how much time they spend training, to really protect their bodies so they can get to that end result, whether it be a college scholarship, high school or college scholarship or beyond.
Yep.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. How is Xavier doing now? Is he back to playing basketball?
He is back to playing basketball. Obviously with COVID, you know, he's not playing with the team or anything, but during my lunch break, you know, we go in the backyard, we have a little hoop. And so we're back there playing one-on-one. I almost beat him in a round the world today, but
notice almost, yeah. That was almost.
But no, he's doing great. And, you know, I think one other thing, you know, speaking of around the world and almost beating him, you know, he went 3 months without shooting a basketball. And, you know, and that's, you know, one of the major skills in the sport and something that people practice a lot. You know, once he was able to shoot again, I would say his shot was, you know, probably back at close to 100% in less than a week. And so, you know, like, you know, advice that I would give parents is, you know, you probably, you know, for the sake of your kids' bodies, you probably could, you know, take some days off here and there. You know, it's like I said, he went 3 months without ever shooting the ball. And then again, like in less than a week, he was back at shooting, you know, 70, 80% from the free throw line and shooting threes and everything else.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. The Warriors will take him now.
But that's also on that point, I think that, that mental space, because our underlying tone with Xavier through this entire recovery process, several times we got the question of, okay, when does Xavier need to get back on the court? And our response was always like, there's no time that Xavier needs to be back on the court. I think doctors and surgeons are so used to that. Okay, here's this, there's this big tournament. There's this, you know, like what is the time frame? We communicated strongly to Xavier, it's when your body is ready and we're in no hurry. And whatever the doctor recommends, we're going to push that out a little bit. We're in no hurry to get you back out on the court and playing scrimmaging or playing in full games. And so I think that also allowed Xavier to have that mental space to recover and to not put undue pressure, you know, to get his shot back. Because I think there's a lot of angst that players feel, you know, to get back to 100%. And so I think the fact that he didn't have that type of pressure actually enabled him to get back to a point where he feels comfortable with his game now.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll definitely have to have you back on when we talk about, at least Nirav and my favorite topic was youth sports and how early is it too early to let your kids start specializing. Thank you very much for joining us, and we wish Xavier the best. And I shoot 85% from the line, so he's going to have to work on beating me.
Let him know that.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Bhundia, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdowne. We look forward to hearing your feedback and hope you look forward to our next episode. Thank you.